Tonight we're going to be talking about the section in the Birkhoff book on the works of God. Look at your table of contents. This is under the general heading of the doctrine of God and creation. And last time we met, we talked about the being of God, God's nature, his names, his attributes, that sort of thing. And then the second main category is the works of God. And under the works of God, we have four things listed. We have divine decrees, predestination, creation, and providence. To discuss any one of these is more than an evening's discussion, right? So we're going to try to do three of the four. So we'll see how that goes. But what that means is we're skimming, right? We're skimming over the, we're getting the overview, we're getting the bird's eye view. Maybe next year we can come back and start doing a microscopic view where we can spend 6 months on one topic and really dig down. But now we're getting the overview, the broad view. Predestination will be deferred until we talk about salvation, because I personally believe that's where it really fits better than here, my opinion. Some would disagree, but we're going to cover it later when we get to the doctrine of salvation. So let's begin with this topic of the divine decrees. Now, when we talk about divine decrees, I want to give an introductory statement, and that is this. This is my personal opinion you're going to get here. Okay, my opinion is that the notion of the... There's a chair right there. Turn it around, baby. Oh, you can sit by Jake. No, man, show me love. Come on up. I mean, be close. Give me some love. I'm inviting you up to the front now. Come on. Okay. So on the subject of the divine decrees, my opinion, and it's only opinions, I think the whole discussion is a little bit misguided. And the reason I say that is because if you've read the book, what you see is that the discussion of the divine decrees is an attempt to understand what God was thinking before time. Okay? And when we look in Scripture, we are not told, other than very broadly, which we'll discuss later, that God created for his own glory. Apart from that, we are not given the specifics of what's called a decree or the decrees, plural. And so, one of the biggest debates in this whole topic is what's called the order of decrees. And I gave you a handout. We'll discuss that very briefly. The irony of it is that the idea that God thinks in the way we think is simply not biblical. God is not thinking logically because he transcends logic. He doesn't say, okay, let me see, I'll do this first, I'll do this, I'll do this third, because his knowledge is intuitive. And I think that this discussion actually raises more problems than it probably solves. But be that as it may, because it's in the book and because if you're going to read any kind of doctrinal books, you're going to encounter this, we'll cover it. But I'm just telling you, I'm not a great fan of this heading of theology. All right, so here's a statement that Birkhoff gives us of the divine decree. The decree of God is his eternal plan or purpose. You know what? I didn't give you guys a handout, did I? Yeah, but I didn't give you my outline, did I?
No. You need it?
No, but do you guys need it? No? All right. The decree of God is his eternal plan or purpose in which he has foreordained all things that come to pass. This is his statement in one of his other books, The Summary of Doctrine, is a similar statement here in the Manual of Doctrine. Now, when you talk about that kind of statement of God's decree, you immediately run into a couple problems. Okay, there's two main problems that all are objections, however you want to look at it, that always come up. One is the problem or the topic of what's called free agency. So if God foreordains all things, including the actions of men, how then is a man morally responsible agent? That's the question. If we say God foreordains all things, and all means all, really all, then how am I free, or how am I a responsible person if God foreordained what I'm going to do? If a man's actions are the product of a divine decree, how is he free to act otherwise? Now, before we attempt to answer that question, it's important to note that even those who believe in a divine decree as defined by Birkhoff, generally called Calvinists, some people might call them hyper-Calvinists, depends, they actually acknowledge human freedom. They acknowledge that there is such a thing as free will, or they may call it free agency. And what Birkhoff says, and others, is they use a statement like this, that God foreordains the free acts of men. I want you to think about this for a moment. God foreordains the free acts of men. Here's how the Westminster Confession puts it in chapter 3. It says this: God from all eternity did by the most wise and holy counsel of his own will freely and unchangeably ordain whatsoever comes to pass. Yet, ready? So as thereby, neither is God the author of sin, nor is violence offered to the will of the creatures, nor is the liberty or contingency of secondary causes taken away, but rather established. So, on the face of, you know, a prima facie reading of this notion of an all-comprehensive decree seems to imply man is not free, and yet those who assert a comprehensive decree will also assert that men are free. Somehow. And they would even assert that the decree makes men free, rather than the opposite. Now we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. The second objection is the existence of evil. If God's foreordained all things that come to pass, including the evil actions of men, then he has ordained sin. Hence, he's the author of evil. And this is often the very common objection to the notion of a comprehensive plan or decree of God, that if God's plan includes man's sin, then didn't God really ordain sin, and hence doesn't that make God the author of evil? So, how do we, if we care to, how do we get out of this dilemma? Or how does Birkhoff, how do theologians get out of this dilemma of asserting a comprehensive decree, yet asserting man is free, or God is not the author of evil? Here's the proposed solution. First, regarding free agency. In many cases, the answer to the objection that a decree eliminates human freedom, often the answer, and this is really Birkhoff's answer, is that the Bible asserts God's decree, the Bible asserts man's free agency or man's responsibility, and you leave the matter there. In other words, it's a mystery. We cannot rationally reconcile them. It doesn't mean they can't be reconciled. It means we can't do it. Okay? Let me give you... Well, here, open your book to page 87. Are our page numbers the same? I forget. Because I have an older one. Okay. Page 87.
It has two. It is said to rob men of all...
Yes, that's it. Okay. Where do I want to start? Okay, at the very top of 87, the first full sentence, but the Bible teaches.
Yes.
You see that?
Yes.
Okay, let's read this together. I'll tell you what, Dan, why don't you start reading there?
But the Bible teaches not only that God has decreed the free acts of men, but also that man is nonetheless free and responsible for his acts. Genesis 50:19.
Okay, he's asserting the Bible teaches that God decrees the acts of men, meaning his decree includes the acts of people, what they do, good or evil. Yet at the same time, the Bible teaches that men are nevertheless free and responsible. Next sentence, or next clause, and
makes no attempt to reconcile the two.
Okay, it makes no attempt to reconcile the two, which is another way of asserting these two things appear to be inconsistent. They appear to not go together, hence they need reconciling. But the Bible doesn't reconcile those for us. It just states these two things. He goes on, we may not be able to harmonize them, but that does not necessarily mean that they are inherently contradictory. Some conceive of the freedom of the will in a way that makes it inconsistent with the divine decree. But theirs is not the proper conception of the free agency of man. Moral freedom is the power of man to determine his moral actions freely in harmony with his previous thoughts and judgments, with his inclinations and desires, even with his very character. This freedom has its laws, and the better they are understood, the more certain it is what a man will do under certain circumstances. God fully understands these laws, and therefore it is quite conceivable that he should determine the future actions of men in such a way as not to impinge on the moral freedom of man, even if we do not fully understand how this can be done. In another one of Burkhoff's books, he simply says this is a mystery. Now, I'm not opposed to mysteries because I think there are mysteries in the Bible. I think the Trinity is a mystery. The nature of Christ is a mystery. Yeah, Rick.
I've been meditating on this for a while. I've been thinking about this. And I just want to know if I'm thinking right. When I look at the creeds and predestination, I look at that and there is a mystery. And I don't have a problem with the mystery either. As a matter of fact, I find that refreshing that I have a God that I completely don't understand. Mm-hmm. When I look at this, and just like it says, you can't reconcile the two, but isn't that because we're trying to explain a God that has no beginning, has no end, a God that knows everything, that it is never changing. So because we're putting this, we're applying this to God and how he looks at us, I'm thinking, right, we're not going to understand this, and it's because we can't think like this because there's nothing. There's no one, no other creature, nothing else like God.
Yeah.
Now, that isn't a good, that isn't something you would argue other than the fact that that's... Am I thinking right?
Yeah.
Am I on the right line?
Well, yeah, I mean...
Am I missing something?
No, I believe that there are mysteries in Scripture, meaning things... Well, the word mystery in the Bible is used a couple of ways. One is something that was hidden that's revealed. And now it is revealed and we understand it. But clearly, the most mysterious thing of all is the very nature of God himself. Okay, so we're dealing with a being which... I mean, let's face it. Even though we have all this revelation, Paul says we see in a glass dimly or darkly. So we're seeing a reflection and it's smudged. Okay, that's the best we can do. And that applies to many things. Now, I think the matters that pertain to our salvation are clear. And I think the Reformers were right to talk about the clearness or perspicuity of the Scriptures, which is the fancy word for it. That when it comes to the matter of salvation, the Bible is clear in its teaching. But there, this is not the kind of thing that you have to fully understand to be saved. So there's this element of you can get so far in comprehending it, and then you stop. Reason can only go so far. And I think it has to do with the nature of God. It has to do with his knowledge, his being, the fact that he's outside of time. I think it's a big deal because I think that has to do with how God knows versus... Yeah. I mean, we're dealing with an infinite being of a completely different order that is... Well, here's the thing.
Where did that humble guy go?
Here's the thing. When you read theology for any length of time, what you find out is men have been grappling with this since the beginning. And you go back to, even in philosophy before Christ, men were still grappling with fate, determinism, So, but then in the church, I mean, for 2,000 years now, men have been grappling with this. And basically, I think that the consensus is this. The consensus is we can't... The Bible seems to be saying two things that we can't fully harmonize. Now, they don't call it a contradiction because they say, logically, it may not be a contradiction, but we can't fully understand. If we could know as God knows, is what Burkhoff is saying, if we knew the laws of human nature the way God knows them, God could foreordain something in such a way that we freely choose it. But we don't understand how that can be.
He's kind of suggesting a potential hypothesis of how God might resolve the contradiction.
Right. Yes. Yeah. But by and large, in my reading, which of course is limited, but in the history of the church, what you find is I think, pretty much a consensus. Regardless of where you fall, more on the sovereignty side versus the free agency side, doesn't matter. Most theologians would contend that ultimately there's an element of mystery in this. Because the Bible talks about God governing, and we're going to talk about providence shortly, and yet clearly we are responsible for our actions. And that is hard to reconcile for us. So I figured if Augustine and Aquinas and Luther and Calvin and all these guys couldn't resolve it, I don't think I'm going to be able to resolve it. Doesn't mean I shouldn't meditate on it and study it and think and pray, but I'm not troubled that I can't resolve it. So let's go on. Now, the question of evil is related to this, because the decree, the notion of a comprehensive decree, seems to imply that God is the author of sin. And so the reply, and I would call it a standard reply, is what's called the permissive decree. All right? Look at your book, Burkhoff, page 86. On page 86, number 7 there. You see it? Mm-hmm. Okay, who would like to read it for us? How about Steve Kintz?
The decree of God with reference to sin is usually called a permissive decree. It renders a future sinful act absolutely certain. But this does not mean that God will, by his own act, bring it to pass. God decreed not to hinder the sinful act of the creature's self-determination, but nevertheless to regulate its control and its result. Regulate and control its result.
Yeah. Now, in this one small paragraph, there's a whole bunch of theology. Okay? And some of the key words here. Obviously, the word permissive, we're going to look at that in a moment more. But he says, it, meaning the permissive decree, renders the future sinful act absolutely certain. Now, when someone hears that phrase, absolutely certain, they think that's a contradiction to any kind of freedom. But what you find is when, and this is like a revelation to me one day when I was reading John Howe, who was a Puritan, the theologians make a distinction between something that is certain and something that is necessary. And it's a very subtle distinction. But if he would have said it is absolutely necessary, then he would have been denying freedom. But to say it's absolutely certain is not denying freedom. It's a very simple distinction. I mean, very subtle. But it's a distinction they make. And that's why he's using that word and not the word necessary. Okay. So what he's saying is that it's certain. It's going to happen. But that's different than saying it necessarily has to happen. Because that would be fatalism, which is a different doctrine. Okay. And then he says God decreed not to hinder. That's really a definition of what a permissive decree is. It's a decision not... It's a decision to permit, or a decision not to hinder. Yet God will regulate and control it. So it's not that God is abdicating his governance, but it's rather how God relates to that particular sinful act. And these are all very subtle distinctions, because that's what theology is, subtle distinctions, trust me. So, now, here's the thing. Um, couple more quick quotes, and then I want to talk more about permissive decree per se. Here's what Calvin said. He said, God knew that it was more suitable to his almighty goodness to bring good out of evil than not to suffer or permit evil to exist. It is more suitable to bring good out of evil than to allow evil to exist. So God, knowing all things, says, evil's bad, but I'm going to permit it because I can bring good out of it. And that's better than the good not existing. So it's kind of like when you look at society and we talk about freedom of speech. Well, because we have freedom of speech, we have to listen to junk. Or because there's freedom of speech, there's pornography. So we say we tolerate the evil because of all the good that comes out of it. Okay, not that we decree the evil or want the evil, but it's permitted because greater good comes out of permitting a certain amount of evil. That's what he's saying. I won't read his quote. Now, here's the thing. This gets dicey. And this is where it gets dicey. I'm going to read this. I need you to pay attention. In what sense can a decree, which by definition certainly determines an event or outcome, in other words, that's what a decree means. It certainly determines the outcome. In what sense can it be permissive? Does not the notion of permission suggest a freedom that contradicts the very definition of a decree? I need you to think about that a little bit, because this is the standard objection to this idea of a permissive decree. In other words, some people say that we were using the permissive decree as a way to get out of the problem, but it's not a real solution. Because whether God decrees a positive decree or a permissive decree, he's still decreeing it. And so you're not really solving the problem. Okay? I think there's an element of truth in the critique, but I do think there's a difference between saying God permits and God actively concurs in an evil act. I think there's a valid distinction there. What we're dealing with here is, I think, ultimately two basic problems. And these are the problems that have not been resolved in 2,000 years. And we're not going to resolve them tonight. Okay. That is, what is the relationship between divine sovereignty and human agency? That's the first fundamental problem or question or issue. And whether you're talking about decrees, whether you're talking about providence, whether you're talking about a variety of things in theology, it boils down to this. Now, when I say I don't think that the relationship of the two can be fully harmonized, I'm not trying to discourage you from thinking about it or studying it or meditating upon it. I'm not doing that. But I do think that this is not, because there's been so much... Here's the funny thing. In one sense, there's been a lot of disagreement and controversy over this. But in another sense, there's been a lot of agreement. Because it's more a tendency of emphasis than anything. And some lean one way, some lean the other way. Some want to emphasize more God's sovereignty, some want to emphasize more human responsibility. I think the Bible does teach us both. And sometimes I preach sermons, and I know that some people are thinking he's a flaming Arminian. And then I preach a sermon, and they say he's a hyper-Calvinist. Well, because when you look at the Word, you have to teach the text that's in front of you. Okay? And what we could do, and I didn't have time to do this, we could actually... And maybe it'd be a fun exercise, a good exercise, is go through just the New Testament and make a chart of all the texts on human responsibility, then make a chart next to it of all the texts on divine sovereignty. Because they're both there. I cannot fully reconcile them. I'm certain from Scripture that I'm going to stand before God and I will be responsible. And I'm not going to be able to say, no, you made me do it. You get what I'm saying? I'm pretty sure of that from the Bible.
The devil made me.
That won't work either. So you know, we're all going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ, give an account of what we've done in our body, whether good or evil. 2 Corinthians 5:10, right? And yet I'm certain that God governs all things, because Jesus said, not even a sparrow falls to the ground without your Father's permission. Can I fully reconcile those in my little brain? No, but I believe both of them with all my heart. Okay. So, this is the ultimate problem as it relates to the creeds. The second issue is the issue of the existence of evil and the goodness and sovereignty of God. You will often find that number two here is the objection you hear when you're trying to share Christ with people. They always want to bring this up. Well, if God's good, then why evil? Okay, and it's a good question. I think it's a valid question. I think it's a question we need to ponder how to answer in an intelligent way. I do think that question can be used as a smokescreen sometimes, but I think sometimes it's a valid question. You don't know people's history. I know a family of Jewish people, and this gal's probably my age, maybe a little bit older. And her ancestors died in a concentration camp in Germany. So when she talks about this, when she talks about the existence of evil, this is not a theoretical objection. She's seen the heart of darkness, the heart of evil, and she needs an answer. So for that reason alone, this is something we need to contemplate, study, and think of how to intelligently articulate it. In an apologetic situation. So, quickly, the order of decrees. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because I actually think this is where a bunch of a lot of the controversy comes on this very topic. But I want you to be aware of these terms because you will run into them. Now, the first term is called supralapsarianism. So when you impress somebody, just start throwing these words out, right?
Yeah.
Supra means above. That's all it means. And lapsarian, or lapse, means the fall. So the question that the theologians were debating is, what is the relationship of God's decree relative to the fall or the permission of sin? Okay. Supralapsarianism says that God decreed to save some and reprobate others, then he decided to create. Then he decided to permit the fall. Now, remember, God's outside of time, so he's not deciding these things like this. But this is really a discussion about, that I think applies more to the question of salvation, the doctrine of salvation, but this is where a lot of theologians put it. So they say God determined salvation and election before he decided to permit a fall. The infralapsarian, or what's often called the sublapsarian, it says, no, God decreed to first create, then to permit the fall, and then to save. That's the proper order to think about God. First, create. Second, permit the fall. Thirdly, to elect and save. You have the handout, so I don't need to read it for you, but it's there, okay? The third is called the infra-redemptarian. Now, this is really confusing because some people call number three here sub-lapsarian and not number two. So you got to pay a lot of attention, because I've read different authors, and as I'm reading them, I'm realizing that some of them talk about three schemes like this, some of them talk about two, some use sublapsarian for infra-redemptarian, and it can get very, very confusing. But essentially, This says God decrees to create, then permit the fall, then provide salvation, a general salvation, and then to elect and save. And these are the three main views. Some would just say there's two, supra and sub. But I don't want to go into that. Really, the order of salvation, the order of decrees, I think is more relevant to when we talk about the doctrine of salvation. And we'll touch a little bit more on this then, but he mentions it here, so I'm just throwing this out, and I wanted to give you the handout. But you will encounter these terms in any kind of when you're doing doctrinal reading, okay? Any questions before we move on? No? Okay. Now we're going to go to... What do I do? I'll save it. Why not? Talk about creation. As I said, we're going to talk about predestination when we talk about... I'm going white to black now. When we talk about salvation, we'll talk about predestination. We'll defer to then. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Glad you could be here. Okay, now, remove this. Okay, we're going to look at a few things regarding creation. One is the time of creation. What do I mean by that? What the Bible teaches, I believe, is that the triune God created or brought into existence all things that now exist, and they are brought into being outside of himself. That is, he brought all things into existence out of nothing. That is called ex nihilo. You've probably heard that term. It's one of the few Latin phrases many people know. Ex nihilo. It simply means out of nothing. So, in the old pagan mythology, or cosmology, God created, meaning God fashioned the world, but he fashioned the world out of pre-existent material. It was already there. The Christian doctrine is that there was no material there. That God brought the material into being out of nothing pre-existent other than himself. And so it is called ex nihilo, out of nothing. He brings all things into being. Let me see something here. Oh, I didn't want to do that. I'm sorry. I got to get better with my PowerPoint. Yeah, we'll talk about that. Okay. So when we talk about the time of creation, creation occurred at the moment that time began. And this is the question we were talking about earlier this evening. If I understand both the Bible and Einstein, and they're of course not equal authorities, is that I think the modern view is pretty much the time came into being when matter did. The time and matter are really interwoven in such a way that they exist together. So God existing before creation meant God existing in eternity, before time, outside of time. And so the creation was not this, just the creation of matter, but space-time. Space-time-matter. The whole continuum of space-time and matter was one thing. And so time began. So when did God create? On day one. That's when it began. That's when time began. The notion of creation ex nihilo, or out of nothing, is opposed... I'll just say it now. Okay. The order of creation. Two things. When I talk about the order of creation, I'm not talking about the days, the order like in Genesis, you know, the 6 days and then the seventh day. I'm talking about two things here. One was called immediate creation, immediate. All right? And this is the creation of matter etc., space, time, matter, out of nothing. That's called immediate creation. The second kind of creation is called mediate, meaning the arrangement of the previously created material. So it says, in the beginning, oh, you got a Bible with you? Let's go to Genesis 1:1. Okay, in Genesis 1:1-2, it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. This is immediate creation. God speaks energy, matter, space, time into being out of nothing. Ex nihilo. Then, verse 3, then God said, let there be light, and there was light. Then God begins this process of arranging this matter, this space-time thing, entity, whatever you call it, which it says was without form. Then he begins to arrange it and give it order. So immediate creation is bringing into being something out of nothing. Mediate creation is God arranging this existing matter, energy, etc. According to a prima facie reading of the Bible, the mediate creation took place in 6 days. Now, I don't want to get into a long thing about this, but I'm just going to bring it up, okay? There's several different views here about creation and about the time or the length of creation. Some believe in a young earth, some believe in an old earth. And those terms are relative because one old earth person might believe in 50 million years and another old earth might believe in 10 billion years. A young earth person might say, I believe it's 6,000. Another might say, I think it's 20,000. But you have this great disparity of opinion regarding the age of the earth, if not the age of the universe. Some Christians have attempted to reconcile an old earth, old universe with a literal six-day creation. So what I mean is, well, I shouldn't say literal, with a six-day creation, there's two ways they try to do it. One's called the long day theory. Okay, you've all heard that one, right?
Yes.
Okay. The long day theory is that here in Genesis, when it says, like in verse 5, it says, God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, so the evening and the morning were the first day. And then it goes on and it says, verse 8, and God called the firmament heaven, so the evening and the morning were the second day. So we see these 6 days, these days of God's activity. The long day view is that these days were periods of unspecified time. We don't know how long the days were. They could have been 1,000 years, hundreds of thousands of years. We don't know. Okay. Now, there's a grammatical problem with this view. Regardless of whether it lines up with science or not, that's not what I'm debating. Now, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but everybody I've read agrees with what I'm going to say. That when the word day is used in the Bible, it's used two ways. Well, actually, it's used more than two. It can mean a literal day, 24 hours, or sunrising, sun, you know, roughly 24 hours. It can be a long period. A day with the Lord is 1,000 years, 1,000 years as a day. It can be an event. The day of the Lord, right? Well, is it literally 24 hours? It's talking about a moment of time, not specifying how long it is. So what does it mean here? That's the question. Because it has a variety of meanings in the Bible, some take the one meaning of it being a broad, it could be a broad period of time, and they insert it and say, well, see, a day with the Lord is 1,000 years, or the day of the Lord doesn't mean literally 24 hours, it means a period of time. So this is an unspecified period of time. The problem with that is grammatically, it's inconsistent with the fact that whenever the word day is used with a number, first, second, third, fourth, it always means a 24-hour day. That's consistent throughout the Bible. So on the one hand, it's true that the word day, which is yom in Hebrew, can mean several different things. Whenever it's linked to a number, it means a literal day. So that's not going to work. So if the universe is really, really old, and this is saying God created in 6 days, then what do? Some people say, well, we don't have to do anything. Others say, well, okay, if we can't make these 6 long periods, then maybe there's another way to get some more time out of this. Maybe there's time in here. Okay. Two more proposals. One is that what we have in Genesis 1:1 isn't the beginning of matter. That really in Genesis 1:1, what we have is God recreating or refashioning what was already there. Now, not that he didn't bring it into being. He brought it all into being, yes. But the account here is specifically God telling us how he fashioned our world. And that actually... Well, it's called the gap theory. Okay. The gap theory says God created, and then there was this time between the moment of bringing it all into existence and the moment he began to fashion it. There's a gap. Now that gap, we don't know how long that gap was, but there's a gap. And so that gap accounts for the apparent age that we see in the universe. Because God could have created everything, but he didn't begin to fashion it for billions of years. Now, why would God do that? I don't know. Could he have done that? Yes. Theoretically, he could have done that. We don't really... Some people try to say grammatically, based upon the Hebrew here, you can really get that out of this. And there is an argument there, okay? I'm not convinced by it. So, now I think the gap theory got discredited because... By in the minds of many people, because some people said, when you look at verse 2 and it says the earth was without form and void, that word form and void are two Hebrew words that when you look at them elsewhere in the Bible, they're always linked to judgment and catastrophe. And they're only used a couple places, but they're used in Isaiah a couple times. And they're it's in the context of a void or without form that is a result of God judging something, and then the ruins. You know, we might say, instead of without form and void, it's like ruins. It's something that's been decimated. The idea of a decimated city, a decimated landscape. So the thought is, why would a perfect God bring into being something that looks decimated? Why wouldn't he just bring it in, you know? Maybe... during this gap time, there actually was some kind of judgment. And so God created everything perfect, but there was a judgment that happened, and then the judgment resulted in the earth being without form and void. And then what we have in the rest of the creation account is God refashioning the world after this judgment. And some people would assert that what is in the gap is the fall of Lucifer. And that somehow the judgment of Lucifer and him being cast down to the earth caused the earth to become desolate. Is it there? Now, here's the thing you have to understand. These are theories that are being proposed because the apparent science is telling us you've got to find more time here. There's got to be more time somewhere. 6 24-hour days isn't going to work. The evidence we have for a a old earth is so overwhelming that you're going to have to find some time. So it either existed before Genesis 1:1 or between 1 and 2 or somewhere. Maybe, maybe not. Now, here's the thing. Here's the question. When Adam and Eve was created, did he have a belly button? Did Adam and Eve have a navel?
I don't know. You're going to tell us. I don't know.
Do we care?
It's relevant. It doesn't sound relevant, but it's relevant. It's relevant to this whole question. Can you figure out why, since you're a brilliant physicist? I bet you can.
Chicken and the egg, that's the same question.
No, it's not chicken and egg. It's not what came first.
How do we know what form it would be in if he created it, fashioned it? You might have some of the same symptoms of something that's been around for a while.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Cut a tree open, how do you know how old it is?
Count the rings.
How many rings were in the trees in the Garden of Eden? When something was created by God, by an immediate act, how old did it look? So Adam was created by God.
How old was he?
He was 1 minute old. How old did he look? He could have looked 1,000 years old.
He was 40, so that's right.
Do you get what I'm saying? What I'm saying is that... Part of the difficulty in this whole question of young earth, old earth is simply the appearance of age. Okay? So when God created something, it appeared a certain age, even though at the moment of its creation, it was only 1 moment old. Yeah. Its own problems?
Yeah,
tons. And I mean, outside of the fact that nobody can really verify it because, well, nobody's been around for many years.
That's part of the problem. That is part of the problem with carbon dating. But there's other clocks.
Just looking across the universe, we can see things that are millions of light years away. Well, the light originated and had to travel all that time at the normal speed of light.
So the light is moving through here.
Exactly. Yeah, that's one of, I think, a more common argument now than carbon dating, because carbon dating has been brought into question.
Carbon dating.
So we're just talking about the light.
The light, yeah. If it's something light years away, well, then if the light's here, and it's traveled, then it must be, the universe must be at least that old. So the age is based upon the size. And they're using light as a calculator. Okay. The problem is, for me, is that although I understand the arguments and the emotional appeal of the age of the universe as it appears, we still don't know what the beginning point was. And if you don't know what the beginning point is, you can't measure. You can't really measure. I don't think. No, I'm not a physicist. But it seems to me, if God creates something, what you have to know how old it is how old was it in appearance? And meaning by the measurement you're using, whether it's rings in a tree, or how do they do horses, their teeth or something? Mm-hmm. You have to know what that clock is, or the ruler is, or you can't measure the thing. So God creates the universe. We don't know how old it looked. God creates Adam. Did he have a navel? Did he look 20? Did he look 40? Did he look 80? What did he look like? Okay, and how would we determine his age? Because he wasn't born and conceived, isn't it? You get what I'm saying? So that's the problem, and I think it's an insuperable problem. Until you know the beginning point and what the standard measurement is, you can never really calculate the age of the universe. Because I personally think, and it's only an opinion, that when God created the universe, it looked billions of years old. Because he shot it out there so fast. Okay? That's what it looked like on day one. But it was only really a day old. But we don't know this. But the problem is we can't really I don't think we can, you know, I don't think we can really calculate it. Bernie?
Isn't the whole problem based on the assumption that we have more knowledge than we actually have? And we think our knowledge is complete.
More knowledge than we actually have.
That, I mean, think about how much, like, you can map the DNA and all that stuff, but how much do we really know? How much more is there to know beyond that? How much more about time and these things is there to know about how God could command it? I really don't see a problem with someone.
No, I agree.
Together, it shouldn't be a stumbling block, but the stumbling block is that man thinks he actually knows something. Partial.
Yeah, well, I agree, because the example I'm using is until you can say what it looked like when it started, you can't say what it's going to look like a billion years later. You don't know that. You can't really answer that question.
How it's going to stay, what its proper state is, or how that may vary.
That's the other thing. What's the other assumption of evolution? It's called uniformitarianism. It's assuming a uniform development. Okay, so you have a uniform measurement, and we don't know that. We know the flood completely disrupted the appearance of the Earth. And so they could make the Earth appear a lot older or younger than it was. We don't know. Yes, so there's a lot we don't know. So I believe God created the universe. I personally believe these are 24-hour days. I think until we know what things look like at the beginning, we can't really calculate what they should look like now. So I think our calibrations of age are skewed. That's my opinion. You might take a long day view. You might take a gap view. We won't excommunicate you for that. Yes?
Just a quick comment. A lot of this, I mean, a lot of people take it from the aspect and part of the discussion that, you know, how does the Bible fit into science versus science fitting into the Bible? But in general, there's, just like Bernie said, a lot we don't know. You know, mm-hmm. We have a finite amount of information. Mm-hmm. But there's a gentleman, a physicist by the name of Paul Humphreys, I believe, who's got some interesting theories about why the Earth looks as old as it is and yet still fitting within a 24-hour period and stuff like mm-hmm. that. And I think that's the biggest thing, is a lot of people try to take the aspect that we have to take science at face value.
Right, so we have to conform our interpretation to modern science,
right,
as if we know modern science is correct. Yeah, and the history of science teaches us that scientific theories change and are often proven wrong.
You're saying, I mean, it's totally, the course of it is based on a very steep assumption of what was it at the beginning, much less have what we consider constants now, have they always been constant?
Right.
We don't know.
We don't know that. Very good. Yes.
Like, the whole reason they made up the gap theory or the long day theory is because they think there's millions of years. What makes us think there's millions of years? You look through the Bible. There's nothing in the Bible that tells us there's billions of years. So what would make us... Because if we look at the world through the Bible, then all we see is what the Bible says about the world.
Yeah, well,
if we look at the world without the Bible, then we come up with millions of years and it doesn't fit.
Yeah, you guys are both saying the same things in different ways. The modern attitude, I think, towards science is there's an operating assumption science is probably correct and needs to be tweaked a little, whereas religion and scripture is anti-intellectual and is, you know, really messed up. That's kind of a modern assumption. It's a worldview assumption. The discussion of creation and these questions of the age of the earth are really relatively modern in their development. Most Christians, probably until around Darwin, there were some before that, just read Genesis at face value. Okay. Now, I will say this one thing about the chronology of the Bible. In the first 10 chapters of Genesis, the first 12 chapters, there's a lot of information about the population, language, and cultures of the world. But the chronology is sketchy because often the genealogies in the Bible skip generations. That's important to know because it will say so-and-so is begat so-and-so or so-and-so is the son of so-and-so, and there might be three generations in there because it will refer, they often go from a grandfather to a grandson. It's not all father, son. because some people have tried to calculate all the genealogies and they've come up with a number about 6,000 years. Well, the problem with that is we know by comparing different versions of the same genealogies that there's some gaps in the genealogies. Now, do I think they're millions of years? No. They're probably thousands of years in some cases. So, you know, I'm just throwing that out there for your general information. So, let's go on. Now, there are several substitutes for creation. In other words, other explanations for the world. One is dualism. Dualism is opposed to creation ex nihilo, because dualism, of the different versions, teaches that matter is eternal. Matter is eternal. This was an ancient view, and it is still a modern view. You will find modern physicists, scientists, who believe that matter is and always was. It is, it was, and forever shall be until it burns out, I guess. So the dualism of this is that, yes, even if there is a God, yeah, maybe God's eternal, but matter was eternal too. And this is an ancient notion, but the modern relevance is that there are people today who believe that matter always existed. So you say to them, well, how do you explain that everything exists? It always did. People have told me, well, it always did. It's always been here. The other substitute for creation is what's called pantheism. This is the notion that God is not ontologically distinct from the creation. That the material creation, I say material, I mean even space and time, if you will, are an extension of God's soul or spirit. Now, Christians believe in the God's attribute of omniscience, right? Or it's called ubiquity, the God's everywhere. But we don't believe that God is everything. So if a Christian says, I believe God is transcendent and he's ubiquitous, he's everywhere, then in one sense, he's in everybody regarding his ubiquity. He would be in, because he'd have to be in, he'd be everywhere. He transcends and permeates everything. But the pantheist means something completely different when he says God is in everything. He means that thing is God. It's part of God's being. We say God is everywhere, but we do not say that everywhere is God. So the pantheist denies creation because the Christian says God creates ex nihilo out of nothing, and the product of the creation is something distinct from God. The pantheist has to say that the world always existed because God always existed, and they're not distinct. They're one thing. One thing. And of course, the third substitute is the idea of evolution. Now, the thing about evolution is, and you probably all know this, there are really two different kinds. Okay, one is called micro and one is called macro. I think it is possible to believe in the observance of development within species. Okay? And that's often called microevolution, but not believe in macroevolution. That is, that one species evolves or develops into another species. Those are two different propositions. Because often when evolutionists want to show us the evidence, what they're really showing us is microevolution, which no Christian should have a problem with. Because to say that you can breed different kinds of dogs or different plants or different fruit flies, or you can see a development within a general species, doesn't mean that one species becomes another species. What we see in here in Genesis, it says that God creates certain things after its kind. The word translated from the Hebrew into English is kind. That is the word we would say today is species. They're distinct species, and one species does not evolve into another species. That's macroevolution. The other thing about evolution that the Christian, I think, has to disagree with is that the development, what evolution is really saying is there is a principle operating within nature that is driving nature. And it's inherent in nature. What the Christian says is that God governs nature. So the principle or power is not inherent in nature. It's in God. Because the question is, how do you have this thing called survival of the fittest when you have animals that don't have reason? They don't have logic. They have simply what's called instinct. So what evolution does is it tries to bring purpose and teleology into matter through the back door. But really, once you start talking about purpose and goals and things of that nature, you're really talking about something that's personal, which means you got to talk about God. Matter is impersonal. It has no direction, has no soul, has no reason. It can have no purpose. All right? There's a whole bunch of other problems with evolution that we're not going to get into tonight. All right, why don't we take a break?